Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Welcome to episode 37 on November 20th, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and...
I'm Ray Goodwin.
And how are you, Ray?
Doing good, Carolyn. How about you?
I'm very well. I always like when holidays are coming up.
You got it. You got it. Yeah. And Thanksgiving has always been my favorite one.
Well, I was going to say it's exactly 1 week today from our U.S. Thanksgiving feast day, the biggest family get-together day of the year and the busiest travel time before and after the big day, even bigger than Christmas, right?
Right.
So everybody loves Thanksgiving. It seems to be the favorite. You don't have to buy presents and all that.
That's exactly it. It doesn't have the crass materialism attached to the religious holiday.
There you go. And people all want to get home for Thanksgiving and be with their family, and that's why there's this, but the traveling, whoo, you know, if you have to take planes and so on, but still they do it. So
that's
because
right.
of that, and you're having a big family Thanksgiving, so we have decided not to try to put on a program next week. There's really no way to do it because, like I said, right before, people are traveling and after, and everybody's busy, so... We're going to skip next week, and I think this might be the first week that we've missed on Table Talk.
I think you're right.
Yeah. Well, we're due for a time off. And, Ray, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, if I'm not mistaken, Christmas and New Year's falls on Thursday.
It's on Thursday, and so if that's the case, I mean, you're always right about these things. So we will be having another break then.
There you go.
And, you know, tonight's show is so good. I mean, tonight's section that you're going to be reading and we're going to be talking about is so good, and I just think there's so much to say about it that I don't mind at all taking 2 weeks before we go on to the next one because there's a lot to digest, you know, think about. I think some of it is what I say when we started this. What's this about? You know, what are people going to think of this? But now I've gotten a lot of better understanding than I had then, and I'm really looking forward to discussing this. And I think there's a lot of learning that can take place for people to understand what was going on then without just trying to avoid it or trying to use it against the Germans.
Certainly.
So... I hope you're up for it.
I agree with that. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I want to make a little bit more. I told people that I would know exactly my schedule by Thursday, and so we've got the Table Talk worked out, but I just want to remind anybody who will be listening to this that I won't be having a program this coming Saturday, 2 days from now, nor will there be a Heretics Hour on November 24th. And so the next program for me will be on Saturday, November 29th. And I have a very good guest lined up. I'm looking forward to that, if he will be ready for that. So I'm having a nice long time off here, and I need it. I've got a lot of things to do. So I hope you will enjoy your week off too, Ray.
No, no doubt. No doubt. All right. I'm fortunate that I'm not the one having to do the driving and the travel, and that my children and grandchildren are coming here, so that's nice.
Yeah. Well, then, but you've got your sister there too, right?
That is correct.
Where you live, so you have to do the cooking, Ray?
I love to do the cooking. They're always volunteering. My children will say, "Dad, we'll fix. You know, we'll cook whatever." And I say, "When you come down here, that's my." And it's not a chore. I love cooking.
Yeah.
And I like to fix up unique things for Thanksgiving. And they also, you know, they'll go to their mother's house for the traditional Thanksgiving with the turkey, with the ham. When they come to daddy's, they have stuff like jambalaya, gumbo.
Oh, I see.
Shrimp.
So you won't be cooking a turkey dinner. I couldn't quite get you
right.
Fixing a traditional turkey dinner, but I know you're a real cook, so.
Yeah, I have cooked a turkey before, and I don't mind doing that, but I just kind of like to serve something that is unusual for them, you know, off the beaten path, so to speak. Yeah.
Good for you. What a good daddy and granddaddy. All right. Well, we better get started here.
Okay.
I've got a bunch of timeline. Well, just two of them now for the 12th. We're starting with the 12th of May. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, on the 12th, the German U-boat U-553, commanded by Kapitän Lieutenant Karl Thurman, it would be probably pronounced German, sinks British freighter Nicoya near the mouth of the St. Lawrence River, signaling the opening of the Battle of St. Lawrence. Well, isn't that in the USA, the St. Lawrence River?
Oh, yeah, that's that divides Maine and Canada, New Hampshire,
yeah.
Vermont. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought. And so the German U-boats, the subs, were really traveling around, weren't they? They were
the
western zone, United States.
Sorry, that we're going to say. They sunk more than a handful off of the Texas coast, too.
Good for them. I had to read about all that sometime because I'm really not very up on that. Well, then we had also on the 12th the Second Battle of Kharkov. In the eastern Ukraine, Soviet forces of Marshal Timoshenko's Southwest Theater of Operations, including Gorodnyansky's 6th Army and Karitonov's 9th Army, initiate a major offensive to capture Kharkov from the Germans. That's, of course, in Ukraine. Well, what is today Ukraine, anyway? 9th Army is to attack first with a primary objective of Krasnograd and a secondary one of Poltava. 6th Army is to follow immediately. After 9th Army has captured Krasnograd, 6th Army is to swing north and link up with the 28th Army and 57th Army, the latter two formations having meanwhile cut the railway between Belgorod and Kharkov. Well, that's all it says. It tells us what they plan to do, what their objectives were. So did they meet their objectives? I guess we'll find out. Okay.
Right.
Well, we can go on now.
12th May 1942 at dinner. Sound economic principles. Problem of fats and whale oil. Prussian colonization mistakes. 100 million Germans in the Eastern Territories. Work of prisoners of war. German migration eastwards. Justification of use of force. Lesson from the French in Alsace. Problem of Alsace-Lorraine. A policy of prudence. Jews with blue eyes and blonde hair. Racial regeneration and moral issues. Marriage by trial. Nostalgia and poetic sense of Nordic races. Moral cannibalism.
Well, you know, with all these topics, this is a very long section. So
yes,
we'll probably stop every so often and talk about it and not wait till we get to the to the whole Bible.
Fine.
Before I forgot what it was about. All right.
Yeah. Okay, if we are satisfactorily to solve the problems of the food plan and the industrial plan, we must get back to sane economic principles. These unfortunately disappeared from the moment that our economists began to influence our politicians. Take fats, for example. Our position now would have been very different if, at the opportune moment, we had paid proper attention to the whale fishing industry and its rational exploitation. Whale oil not only possesses anti-rickets virtues, but also has the advantage that it can be stored indefinitely. We have today various processes which enable us to make good use of 88% of a whale. Apart from the oil, the meat can be preserved, leather can be made from the skin, and the fin coverings furnish the basis for a material to all intents and purposes indestructible. The organization of our whale fishing industry is therefore for us a problem of the most pressing significance.
Well, you know, right
call
there.
Yeah.
Right there, I'd like to comment on this little part, sort of stands out by itself. But I just love to hear Hitler talking like that. You know, he's so clearly thinking about what is best for the nation and the people and so on. He's not at all thinking about companies and, owners of companies and what's good for them like we do in our type of economy and who's going to make money off of this and so on. It's all based on, you know, how can we, and it's frugal, too. It's like we could do some whale fishing. And, of course, people are against fishing whales. I understand that. But back then, they weren't so sensitive to it. And they could make use of every bit of the whale and get all this stuff out of it and solve a lot of their oil problem and their fats because they always were short of fats in their diets, in general, because of the not having enough of that. So, you know, I just, it's also ecology focused and thinking about how they can just keep making things better and making better use of what their opportunities are.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of it is health based as well. I think he is always conscious of that.
Mm-hmm. He is.
Okay. Gauleiter Forster recalled that in 1830, the population of the town of Thorn was predominantly German, but that by 1939, the German element had dwindled to quite insignificant proportions.
Let me just say that this Forster is does it say there? The Gauleiter of Danzig, West Prussia. And his first name is Albert, and you know there was a lot going on. I read quite a bit of that today. A lot going on about Danzig, West Prussia, and what they were doing. So I hope I'll be able to add a little bit of enlightenment as we go along.
Okay. When Forster was talking about the German population element had dwindled to quite insignificant proportions by 1939, this elicited the following reflections from the Führer. The fault lies with the policy pursued by Prussia during the last 150 years. During that period, the Prussian government transformed the German eastern territories into a veritable punitive colony, sending only such teachers, government officials, and officers as had, for some reason or other, fallen from grace, or whom it was desired to remove from the functions they had been exercising. We must make good the mistakes committed by Prussia, and we must do it in the next 10 years. At the end of that period, I shall expect my Gauleiters to be in a position to inform me that these regions have become once again German. Forster agreed that this might be achieved in the Danzig, West Prussian province. To succeed, it would be necessary, he thought, to appeal to the best elements of the Old Reich and to restrict recruitment to men under 50. To men above that age, one could well apply the adage, old trees cannot be transplanted. The Führer then says, I agree. For the repopulation of our eastern territories, it is to the younger generation, obviously, that we must turn in the first instance. We must imbue them with a feeling of pride in being invited to go to a country where they will not find their bed nicely made for them, but will be compelled, on the contrary, to create from the beginning. And we must make them understand that we expect them to build up something truly magnificent. One attraction which will certainly appeal to the young is that by immigrating in this fashion, they will find opportunities for promotion infinitely more rapid than those of their less enterprising comrades who remain quietly at home, content to follow the beaten track. My long-term policy aims at having eventually 100 million Germans settled in these territories. It is, therefore, essential to set up machinery which will ensure constant progression and will see to it that million by million German penetration expands. In 10 years' time, we must be in a position to announce that 20 million Germans have been resettled in the territories already incorporated in the Reich and in those which our troops are at present occupying. Of what can be done for the inhabitants of these regions in the way of civilized amenities, we can get some idea from the Poles, who themselves have succeeded in laying out in the heart of the town of Gotenhofen, Gdynia, a series of broad and beautiful arterial roads. Gauleiter Forster intervened,
You want to say anything about this part here? No? I'm trying to think if we should.
Just got it there.
Yeah. Well, you know, what they're talking about, the background on this, is that that Prussian territory got was full of Poles. We had a lot of Polish people there. And
right.
So they were trying to make it more German. And this is what the Poles call the Germanization of Poles. You know, they're always complaining about Germans wanting to Germanize the Poles. But, of course, whenever the Poles got the opportunity, they were trying to Polonize Germans and everybody else. You know, they wanted to Polonize, and everybody does that. If they can't get the people out of their territory, they want to make them more like themselves and make them, you know, get them on their side. So now the Germans were in charge, and they were sending Germans there, trying to Germanize the area so it wasn't so Polish. And this is Hitler's time, but back in, maybe I should wait until they talk about that. They are going to talk about Frederick the Great and what he did.
Okay. Gauleiter Forster intervened. Even in wartime, he claimed, there were certain cultural aspects which should not be neglected. Turning to the example of Gotenhafen, he remarked that the town possessed three small cinemas, but not one large one. The result was that when warships came into the port to rest, the sailors, whose delight it is to go ashore, were unable to find those distractions they eagerly desired. The materials necessary for the construction of a large entertainment hall, which could later be equipped as a cinema, were certainly available on the spot. The construction could not be undertaken because the necessary labor, which could easily be furnished by 60 Russian prisoners of war, had been refused. The Fuhrer continued. Now, here's a note. I just want to say this for the audience. Where that says the Fuhrer continued, and it says, note by Martin Bormann. These pages contain many inaccuracies. In the notes taken of a conversation of considerable length, Dr. Picker fails to indicate precisely who were the speakers and who uttered the various opinions expressed.
Well, okay, right. And so this was a long conversation.
Yes.
And I don't think we've got it all. And maybe we have most of it, but that was the kind of the impression I had. And And again, we don't know. It's like it's all being said by Hitler. Although in some cases it does say somebody else is speaking. I think it does.
Yeah, Forster in particular. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. The Fuhrer continued. In a case like this, we must use common sense, and an undertaking which is so obviously desirable must not be allowed to lapse simply for want of temporary prisoners of war labor. If Gauleiter Forster has the necessary material at his disposal, then we must forthwith give him the prisoners he needs for the completion of the construction. Generally speaking, I am of the opinion that in cases like this, practical consideration should be regarded as the determining factor, and particularly so when it is a question of construction to be undertaken in the Eastern territories. One must resolutely turn a blind eye to the counsels of moderation emanating from a tea table conference in Berlin. The mistakes made by the Prussian government in these territories, which we are trying to resuscitate, are too numerous for us to be hidebound by theoretical edicts. From the cursory research made into the causes of the diminution of population of Germanic origin in the regions, two appear to stand out. They are the nobility and the clergy. We know quite well to what degree the Roman Catholic Church made common cause with Poland in the political struggles. What is less known is the fact that in these regions, the German nobility was entirely indifferent and took no pains at all to put German interests before all others. On the contrary, with these gentry, the question of caste was of primary consideration even when it was a question of Polish nobles. Gauleiter Forster is perfectly right when he says that this tendency was greatly fostered by common keenness on shooting and hunting, which constituted a species of open-air Freemasonry. Everything possible was done to dispossess the small German landowner and to replace German agricultural laborers by Poles. Indeed, it is no exaggeration to say that the German nobility struck a mortal blow at the Germanic conception and undermined all the efforts that were made to maintain it. Now, I was going to comment a little bit on that right there, because I can't read a lot of this stuff without thinking about USA. And when he says German interests were totally neglected by the ones you would think would be looking out the most for it, and that would be the German nobility, maybe the better educated, the at least those with some personal wealth. But on the contrary, he says these people were more interested in socializing with people of the upper level in Polish society rather than their own German kinsmen. They would rather be shooting and hunting, and that's why he called it a species of open-air Freemasonry. And then he talks about dispossessing the German land, small German landowners, replacing German agricultural laborers by Poles. I mean, what does this sound like here? I mean, it's kind of like a bracero program down south here, where they bring in Mexicans and whatever, and over there, like that, the German who tried to survive or raise his family by being a farm laborer, agricultural laborer, was kind of just shunted aside and replaced with Polish workers. And this is certainly why a lot of those people left and went other places, and the German percentage of the population plummeted. And as Hitler correctly says, a big reason for that was this nobility. These bourgeoisie, as he will later call them. So anyway, I just wanted to add that.
Well, that's right. And they related to the Polish nobles. Polish nobles were the biggest landowners in Prussia, from what I've been reading, is that Poles owned a whole lot, I don't have the figures here, but a lot more land, a lot bigger percentage of the land than the Germans did. And so they probably enjoyed going there, and they all treated each other very nicely and entertained one another, and they got along just fine. They weren't thinking in terms of a nation, in terms of the way that Hitler thinks about it. They weren't thinking that way at all. So it is a perfect example of what goes on in the U.S. and so many other places. The same with this whole idea of European. You know, the European elite will be all hobnobbing with one another. They're not going to care about the average European person when
that's
it all
exactly
becomes Europe.
Correct.
You know?
Yeah.
And the Poles have complained and written about how terrible it was when the Germans wanted to make their presence felt and so on. But, you know, before that, the Poles had done that. This was not originally Polish. The Poles had been around in there, but they didn't. They had been. Other people had been in charge. The Germans had been in control of it before, and then the Poles got in control of it more. And then the Germans came back with Prussia, and during that time, and tried to reassert themselves a little bit. But it was just as he said, they didn't do a good job. And that's what he meant in the beginning when he said that the policy has been very bad in Prussia, and a lot, they had to do something about it. And then I think he said the last 150 years, it wasn't good, and then he needed to do something within 10 years. He wanted to make some big changes there. And this Forster,
right.
Yeah, this Forster is known as having, you know, a hatred for the Poles and treating the Poles very badly. And in one case, now, you know, I've discovered that there's more pages about the Poles on Wikipedia than you can imagine. I just found some more of them. And they're all written by Poles. And here's one that's called Polish Anti-Polish Sentiment, Persecution of Poles. And it's full of all this stuff. And it's written by Poles, and most of the sources are not only written by people with Polish names, but they're in Polish. So unless you're Polish, you don't even read it, and I don't think anybody would want to unless they're Polish. So they've done a tremendous amount of work in writing to cause Poles to feel like they see their version of history. But this thing about, they quoted our friend Forster, they have him using the word subhuman, you know. And they always do that. They translate Untermensch as subhuman.
Yes.
And it's not, that's not right, because it's underman. And when you were, we just came upon this good part here where it says, well, here he says, in 1937, he supposedly boasted about his fight against subhumans and communists. But, you know, he said Untermensch and communists. That's what he, that's what it actually was. And you
right.
can compare that to speaking about Untermensch, speaking about upper and lower classes. We use that term, upper class and lower class, all the time. It might not be as popular now. I don't know. Maybe they call it working class. But, you know, that's always been there. And that's all that it means by Uber. That's right, Uber mentioned and Untermensch. So they use this to say that the Germans were calling all these Slavs subhuman, and they never did that. And you can't get rid of that. You know, and it gets in people's
yep.
minds, too, because they read it all the time.
Sure.
So, but this Forster was pretty pretty much trying to put carry out Hitler's ideas, and he was really strong-minded about it himself. They also mentioned up here, which when Hitler said he complimented what the Poles had done in, well, they call it Gottenhofen, but Gdynia, the other port that they built, which meant that they didn't really need Danzig anymore, but they wanted both of them. In any case, that was pretty interesting, I thought.
Yeah, and, you know, one other idea that struck me, Carolyn, as I read this, and that last sentence kind of says it, where he says, indeed, it is no exaggeration to say that the German nobility struck a mortal blow at the Germanic conception and undermined all the efforts that were made to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
To me there, it once again shows that Hitler is looking at this whole thing there with the German people on the decline there and the nobility ignoring them. He is thinking in terms of blood and of race, where they're thinking in terms of the mark or the dollar sign, and you know, ignoring the reality of their own people. And that, to me, was what he means when he says the struck a mortal blow at the Germanic conception, which is family ties by blood. And you know, that's I got that out of that anyway. I stopped where it says the Prussian government by failing to take measures to counteract these tendencies.
Okay,
gave proof
I'm not
of it.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Gave proof of its total ignorance of historic values. The German emperors obviously had very good reasons when they applied themselves to the task of forming and maintaining in these southeastern territories a number of small Germanic colonies. It was done deliberately. And it was the aim of their policy that there should live and develop in these marshes of the Reich a population of Germanic origin as dense as possible. If we wish to correct the mistakes of the last century in this respect, we must act decisively. We must remember the example set by the Knights of the Germanic Orders, who were by no means kid-gloved. They held the Bible in one hand and their sword in the other. In the same way, our soldiers in the East must be animated by the National Socialist faith and must not hesitate to use force to gain their ends if need be.
All right, so we here, you know, he's making it, he makes it clear that he's very serious in intending to Germanize the areas that Germany has won, you know, has won back in some cases.
Yes.
And people, he's criticized. I mean, there are all these people there who criticize that, like he didn't have a right to do it. But other people's, the other people's do it. And as we know, you know, the strongest are the ones who should survive and do the best, because they do the best leadership, they do the best work. So, if, you know, you this these are ways in which you increase the strong ones and decrease the weaker ones. And that's a part of the natural order thing also. And, of course, it's been done to Germany for sure.
Well, yeah. And I you know, and I think that you have to keep in mind here Versailles and how Germany was dumped on after that war, and they had this formed this Polish corridor to split Prussia, and so much of what was German became that was given to the Poles. And so when Hitler's talking about doing this stuff, a lot of the territory he's talking about was German to start with and was taken away from him. Their people were forced out one way or the other, and that's part of it, too.
Yeah.
After World War One.
Yeah, and after winning it back, they're not going to give it up again. So that was
right.
His idea. We're not going to give this up again. We cost too much to get it back. And so, and that splitting Germany with that Polish corridor was a huge mistake. Now that caused such a
yes.
problem. It's never been done.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody knew that, but still.
And it was done on purpose.
Yeah, right. And now we're going to talk about Alsace-Lorraine a little bit.
Right. We can even learn a lesson from the way the French behaved in Alsace. Without the slightest regard for the generations of men who would have to suffer in consequence, they set to work to eradicate from Alsace every vestige and trace of German influence, thrusting brutally the customs and the culture of France down the throats of the inhabitants. Acting in the same way, we will mercilessly wipe out bilingualism in these territories, and the radical methods to which we shall have recourse will themselves prove their efficiency, even on the population hostile to Germanization. We shall rapidly achieve a clear-cut situation so that by the second generation, or at latest by the third, these regions will have been completely pacified. As regards Alsace and Lorraine, if we want to remake these into authentic German provinces, then we must drive out all those who do not voluntarily accept the fact that they are Germans. Gerlauter Berkel has already taken severe measures in this sense, but we shall still have to get rid of a further 250,000 of Frenchified Alsatians. Should we send them to France, or should we send them to colonize the Eastern territories? From the point of view of principle, this is of no great importance. It is just a question of opportunity. And to fill the void left by their departure presents no problem at all. Baden alone can provide innumerable peasant sons willing to settle in Alsace and Lorraine, particularly as there is little room for them to remain in their own homeland. Actually, the farms in Baden are too small to allow a German family to rear on them a family of more than two children. As regards
well,
the
right, and what they had there, you know, like in Baden, which is true, in Baden they had, they just had small area, small farms, and the eldest son inherited the farm, and the others had to go and find some other way to live. You know, they had to come up with something for themselves, and there weren't a lot of opportunities within a kind of a class-conscious
right.
place. And so they learned, you know, trades and so on. And that's why so many of them from there went off into the East in the 1700s when my ancestors did that, some of them, you know.
Yep.
Because the farms couldn't support more than a couple, more than one family. So so Hitler's looking at this and trying to open up territory for Germans. There's no doubt about it. And I don't think there's any need to apologize for that just because the neighbors didn't like it.
That's right.
You know, that was the program. So like it or not, right. I mean, won't like it, but still, that was the program.
Mm-hmm. As regards the Germanization of the Eastern territories, we shall not succeed except by the application of the most severe measures. Nevertheless, I am convinced that these territories will bear a profound Germanic imprint after 50 years of National Socialist history. Now, this is a written part here by...
Picker.
What was it? Yeah.
Yeah, Henry Picker.
Okay. Yeah, so this is not Hitler speaking here. Gerlauter Forster quoted the problems raised by numerous special cases. He quoted the case of a Polish workman employed in the theater at Graudenz who wished to become a German national and stated in support of his claim that he had a German grandmother. Should an application of this kind be rejected out of hand? One thing was certain. no German would wish to do the work that this Pole was doing in the Graudenz Theater. There were, added Forster, the problems of the Catholic Sisters of Charity, who were doing splendid work among victims of contagious diseases, and of the Polish women working in the household of a badly wounded German. In Forster's opinion, if any Pole desired to acquire German nationality, the decision should depend upon the general impression made by the candidate. Even in cases where it was not possible to trace exactly the antecedents of the individual, there were nevertheless certain ethnical characteristics which, taken in conjunction with character and standard of intelligence, gave sure guidance. According to Forster, it would appear that Professor Gunther, a specialist in these matters, was quite right when he asserts, after a tour of 10-odd days through the province of Danzig, that 4/5 of the Poles living in the north of that province could be Germanized. When called upon to make decisions in such cases, one should not forget, added Forster, that real life is always stronger than theory, and that therefore one should Germanize wherever possible, bearing in mind past experience and relying on one's common sense. In the southern and southeastern parts of the province, it would be better to start by establishing garrisons with the object of resuscitating the population, and only later to examine the possibilities of Germanization. The thing to be avoided in all these regions and throughout the intermediary period was the introduction of German priests. It would be far better to support the Polish clergy. Polish priests, with the pressure that could be put on them, would prove more malleable. One could count on their going each Saturday to the governor and asking what should be the subject of their sermon for the next day. Even better would be to persuade the Polish bishop to remain in close touch with the German Gauleiter, and thus to ensure the transmission through him of all the instructions thought desirable to the priests under him. In this way, Forster concluded, it would be possible to maintain order in the country, even during the transition period. The views of Gauleiter Forster.
Okay, we've got another note here.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're exactly right. A marginal note in Bormann's handwriting says, according to Forster's opinion, which is quite wrong. So, you know, yeah, he had to let people know that this part that was transcribed was certainly not something that he went along with.
Right, right. So that's pretty good that this is what someone, well, what was that before? He didn't make it clear. Was that Bormann? That was Bormann complaining about that. So that's why he's written this now, because he says, well, you know, this is, let's remember, this is Forster's stuff.
That's right.
My Hitler stuff.
Yeah, well, to make certain that everybody knew this was not the Führer speaking.
And this is another evidence that Bormann is not changing the copy. He's not rewriting what the note-taker is doing. And
very good point.
I really think that Bormann is... was somebody who was so, I do believe he was extremely loyal to Hitler, just as Hitler thought and just as he always said, and people close there thought. I don't know anybody who was really inside there who called Bormann a Russian spy or anything like that. That's all, or then also a British spy or something, but that's all stuff from people that didn't know anything. So he this project went on and he left it, he allowed it to be the way it was. But he did make these little notes, which are helpful. And now he's thinking, apparently, Forster's thinking, and he's the one who's the Gauleiter there. He's thinking that the Polish churchmen would be a lot more malleable. They would go along with what the National Socialist government was all about better than the German priests.
Yeah.
The German priests, he would have thought, were smarter, better educated. And they had their own ideas, and they were, you know, going to be more independent and so on. So
a lot less subject to manipulation.
Yeah. But he thought that the Polish ones would, for all the strength that we, that sometimes the resistance of the Polish Roman Catholics, still, I guess he thought in this condition and up there in the situation that they would go along with things. And he was a Gauleiter, so he was looking for it to keep order and not to have people giving him trouble. So Borman says, well, this is his idea, but Borman thinks it's wrong.
And that's taken note of the paragraph I'm fixing to read here, where it says, the views of Geilider Forster met with strong opposition, especially from Reichsleiter Borman. The latter admitted the necessarily empirical character of some of the decisions to be taken, but maintained that as regards the Poles, care should be exercised not to Germanize them on too wide a scale, for fear they might inoculate the German population with too strong a dose of their blood, which could have dangerous consequences. At this point, the Führer spoke again.
Well, I think this is, I just have to mention here, see, that Forster was a lot more pro, let's just try to Germanize as many as who are seem to be willing to go along with the program. And Borman is much more racially selective, and, you know, he was pretty much that way, and Hitler's probably somewhere in the middle. But we'll see here.
Yeah. It is not possible to generalize on the extent to which the Slav races are susceptible to the Germanic imprint. In point of fact, Tsarist Russia, within the framework of her pan-Slav policy, propagated the qualification Slav and imposed it on a large diversity of people who had no connection with the Slavonic race. For example, to label the Bulgarians as Slavs is pure nonsense. Originally, they were Turkomans. The same applies to the Czechs. It is enough for a Czech to grow a mustache for anyone to see from the way the thing droops that his origin is Mongolian. Among the so-called Slavs of the South, the Dinars are predominant. Turning to the Croats or Croats, I must say I think it is highly desirable from the ethnical point of view that they should be Germanized. There are, however, political reasons which completely preclude any such measures. There is one cardinal principle. This question of the Germanization of certain peoples must not be examined in the light of abstract ideas and theory. We must examine each particular case. The only problem is to make sure whether the offspring of any race will mingle well with the German population and will improve it, or whether, on the contrary, as is the case when Jew blood is mixed with German blood, negative results will arise. Unless one is completely convinced that the foreigners whom one proposes to introduce into the German community will have a beneficial effect, well, I think it's better to abstain. However strong the sentimental reasons may be which urge such a course on us, there are plenty of Jews with blue eyes and blonde hair, and not a few of them have the appearance which strikingly supports the idea of the Germanization of their kind. It has, however, been indisputably established that in the case of Jews, if the physical characteristics of the race are sometimes absent for a generation or two, they will inevitably reappear in the next generation. One thing struck me when I visited the arsenal at Graz. It is that among the thousand suits of armor to be seen there, not one could be worn by a present-day Styrian, for they are all too small. To me, that is proof that the representatives of the Germanic tribes who settled formerly in Styria not only infused new strength into the indigenous bloodstream, but also, by virtue of their own more vigorous blood, imposed their own attributes on the natives and thus created a new racial type. This encourages me to station troops who are ethnically healthy in those regions where the race is of poor quality and thus to improve the bloodstock of the population.
You want to say anything about this?
That's pretty good, though.
Yeah, he's pretty good, isn't he? He always makes a lot of sense. I think it's very interesting that he agreed or felt that a lot of these people called Slavs were not really of Slavic whatever's supposed to be Slavic blood, but they've been called Slavs, and he said that was the Russians who did that to try to include as many people as possible within what they were, you know. And I suspect that, too. I think it's interesting that he says the Czechs have a Mongolian origin just because of the way their mustaches droop. I don't know.
That was some observation.
Yeah, well, he must have some reason, but he's pretty familiar with the chicks. But this idea about being Germanized is clearly now that they take people who they think have a good genetics and similar to Germans enough, and they have good characters and so on, and they actually bring them into the German community, and they think of from then on of themselves as German, and when they have children, their children will just consider themselves German. And see, on other groups, like the Poles, especially in the Czechs, you know, they think that's terrible. And, of course, we think today that that's a kind of genocide because you're taking away their. And when it happens to Germans, I think it is too. But that's the Germans. See, there was not going to be a Poland anymore. And the Germans were taking over that whole area. And so it would have been a benefit to go, you know, to be a part of the German community and to be considered German. That would have been a benefit to these people. Of course, Hitler always had big plans, and they didn't pan out. So in the end, you could say that, it's all kind of null and void, the whole question.
Right, right. I didn't look this up, and I wish I would have now, but where he says when Hitler's talking about one thing that struck me when I visited the arsenal at Graz, or G-R-A-Z.
Yeah, Graz. They pronounce it Graz. Graz.
Where would that be located? And I meant to
That's in Austria. And Styria is pronounced Styria. That's in Austria. It's what I consider, it's not really so much Eastern, but it's kind of the Eastern half. Below Vienna. Graz is below Vienna, and it's the second largest city in Austria, and Styria is where the Wengers come from, and that's an important what do you call that, a county kind of type of province, and it's right next to Carinthia, which is further south, though, which is where Willie Crispin was from.
The reason why I was interested in that was because, when he says he viewed those thousand suits of armor to be seen there, and then he says not one of those could be worn by a present-day Styrian, for they're all too small. And then he says that's proof that the infusion of these Germanic tribes improved the heck out of that race. Well, a number of years ago, when I was working, I worked with a fellow that took his family on a vacation to Europe. And when he came back, he was telling about the sights he had seen and everything. But one of the things that really struck him was he said they toured some museums in Rome. And he said in one of those museums, they had several of these suits of armor worn by the Romans. Way back in the day, 400, 500 A.D., whatever, and he said stood out and struck him immediately was, he said, Ray, those suits would not fit my 13-year-old boy today. He said, I was shocked at the small size of those. And that, that made an impression on me. But, I mean, I know that over the years, you sometimes don't consider the infusion of like a Germanic tribe's blood or whatever. You think of, well, health has gotten better, we're eating more.
Well, it is also our diet. It is the meat. Makes you much bigger and taller. And they, as Hitler said, that those Romans didn't have a meat diet. They lived on grain and vegetables and so on. And he thought they were so big and so strong and such great warriors. Well, they had other small people to fight, I guess. Because it's clear that what the Asians, when they start eating more Western style, they start getting taller and more filled out. So I think diet is a bigger part of it than the different tribes coming in. Because I think those tribes came pretty early. I'm not sure about what years he's thinking about here. But see, he's a vegetarian, so maybe that's why he wants to ignore the fact that that it's having more meat to eat that makes you bigger. And, you know, proteins, any kind of good protein, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They are superior. Eggs are the best, but they're a superior protein to vegetable protein.
And just, you know, as a Texan, I have to throw this in. I've made a lifelong study of the Texas Revolution and things that happened back then and the fights that, you know, people are familiar with, the Battle of the Alamo, San Jacinto, and the average Mexican foot soldier at that time was 5'3" to 5'4", weighed 120
wow.
pounds.
Wow!
You know, and the average Anglo settler or soldier in Texas, the average was 5'8" to 5'9", 150 to 160 pounds. And so when they got into it hand-to-hand, you know, if the numbers weren't overwhelming on the Mexican side, they got whipped. And it was because of the sheer physical size and strength, the difference between the two forces.
Yeah.
And, you know, so something like that, I mean, you take
Well, that's another reason for Hitler to say we don't want to treat our places where we're going to be occupying and being in control of, we don't want to treat them like we treat ourselves. We don't want to feed them the way we feed ourselves,
right.
You know. We don't want to educate right. them the way we, because they're just going to, you know, become very strong and able to fight us off, and we're going to have a big fight on our hand. We don't want that. Why should we do that to ourselves? And, you know,
that's
you can't exactly blame
right.
them for that.
Mm-hmm. True.
Again, we have to look at nature. All these people are talking about nature is the teacher. Well, that's what nature teaches you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't find any different species that are competing. You don't find them giving their food or whatever to their competitors
exactly.
at all.
That's right.
Ooh,
anyway, we'll go on here. You may object that such a practice might well undermine the moral sense of the German people. My answer to that is that it is just the sort of horrified objection one would expect from the moral hypocrite and the pretentious upper 10,000. These people are shocked at the idea that a Turk may have 4 legitimate wives, but they admit that the Prussian princes had 40 and often more mistresses in the course of their lives. Such hypocrisy drives me to fury. The Prussian prince, as he gets bored with his successive mistresses, can pack them off like bits of refuse of no importance. And we have here among us blackguards who regard them as men of honor. And these same renegades heap sarcasm on the honest German citizen who, with complete disregard of caste, marries the girl by whom he has had a child. It is these hypocrites who are responsible for mass abortions and for the existence of all those healthy women deprived of a man simply as the result of reigning prejudice. Is there a more lovely consecration of love, pray, than the birth of a handsome babe, glowing with health? Although it is obvious to the eyes of any reasonable person that nature blesses the love of two beings by giving them a child, these sinister degenerates claim, if you please, that the status of a man or a woman depends on a sealed document given by the state, as if that were of any importance in comparison with the ties which unite two people in love. To my way of thinking, the real ideal is that two beings should unite for life, and that their love should be sanctified by the presence of children. If our forms have remained often for centuries, in some cases for as long as 700 years, in the possession of the same family, it is for the most part because marriages were arranged only when an infant was on the way. And for centuries, the Catholic Church bowed to this custom and tolerated what was called the trial. When the birth of the infant was imminent, the priest would remind the future father of his duty to marry. Unfortunately, the Protestant Church has broken with these healthy customs and has prepared the way, with the aid of laws, written or unwritten, for a hypocrisy whose object it is to stigmatize as something shameful a marriage which has been provoked by the arrival of a child. And don't let us forget, if we're going to be completely truthful, that a large portion of the Prussian nobility owes its existence to a faux pas on the part of one of the girls of the bourgeoisie. I like that, boy. He lets those hypocrites have it with both barrels on
that.
Well,
I was going to say, this is like a rant. You can just, it's like he got this on this, and he's going on a little rant here. And it infuriates him. And isn't he a good person? My God.
Absolutely. You know, and these Prussian nobility, these turning their noses up at an unwed pregnant girl or woman, and yet he says a lot of them owe their existence to the fact that, some girl, got pregnant without being married. And and he really hammers them for the...
There's so much illegitimacy among the nobility. There's a lot of illegitimacy. They either take him into the, and they would take him into the family, you know, and try to kind of cover it up. So a lot of these nobility came from probably very healthy young girls, young women with good blood, good genes, you know.
That's right. That's right. And I thought it quite interesting because I wasn't aware of this part where he says, for centuries the Catholic Church bowed to this custom and tolerated it. And yet the Protestant Church came along and says, boy, this is a sin. And he says they actually broke with the healthy customs and then wrote their laws for hypocrisy, whose object is to stigmatize as something shameful a marriage provoked by the arrival of a child. I love that reasoning.
Yeah, and that was so true. He's so familiar with that because that was going on when he was probably, young and before that, where it happened so much in Austria and other places too, but I know it happened a lot in Austria, where women got pregnant, and then the church would try to talk the man into marrying her. They wanted them to get married, but sometimes they didn't, you know. They weren't stigmatized. Life went on. In fact, as we know, Hitler's father was born of a woman, that one with the long name, who I should know it, but it's not coming to my mind right at the moment, who didn't want to marry the man who was his father. And later, and we know now why, he was already married, and she didn't want to upset his marriage and his other children. And so she remained single, and she was a very strong woman, and this was Hitler's father, and eventually she married this man's brother, and so that Hitler's father could move into his real father's home, who was then his uncle, known as his uncle, who had a nice family with the other children, and she was already in her 40s, and she married this older man who was this real father, the real father's brother, and she didn't live real long. Actually, she died in her 50s. But she was a very good woman and thrifty and all that stuff. And that's part of Hitler's family ancestry.
Sure, I think that name that you were trying to think of, wasn't it Schicklgruber?
Yeah, Schicklgruber. Right. I knew it started with an S.
Yeah.
Right.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Moreover, these prejudices only operate in reverse, and logic has no bearing on the trend of our desires. For the admissibility of the dissolution of marriage on account of incompatibility is legally recognized. If it is contrary to the law of nature to insist on the maintenance of a union in which the partners are unable to agree, it is no less wrong to put obstacles in the way of a marriage justifiable on the grounds of perfect reciprocal unity. My age saves me from the suspicion that I'm perhaps pleading pro domo, and so I am able to invite attention to the importance of this problem. I shall have no peace of mind until I've succeeded in planting a seed of Nordic blood wherever the population stand in need of regeneration. If at the time of the migrations, while the great racial currents were exercising their influence, our people received so varied a share of attributes, these latter blossomed to their full value only because of the presence of the Nordic racial nucleus. Thus it is that we have acquired a sense of poetry, a tendency to nostalgia, which finds its expression in music. But It is thanks to those attributes that are peculiar to our race and which have been preserved in Lower Saxony that we have been able harmoniously to absorb extraneous characteristics. For we possess one faculty which embraces all the others, and that is the imperial outlook, the power to reason and to build dispassionately. In the notes in which the ideas of Frederick the Great were jotted down, I was pleased to find, again and again, opinions similar to those I have just expressed. For instance, when Der Alte Fritz stigmatizes as moral cannibalism the opposition to his healthy racial policy, which was on all fours with our own, and when he comes out in favor of marriage based on the presence of an illegitimate child, then I have nothing but approval.
Hey, you know, this is where I've got a little bit here about Frederick the Great and this page on the persecution of Poles, because Frederick the Great was a real German, and pro-German in the sense that Hitler likes. You know, he was really wanted to Germanize Prussia, and he was working on it, which makes him hated by Poles. Poles think he's a terrible guy, you know, as bad as Hitler, On this page at Wiki, it says that there was a long-standing trope that can be traced back to Frederick the Great, who supposedly is quoted as likening the slovenly Polish trash in newly reconquered West Prussia to the Iraqi Indians. And that they think that's a terrible insult to them. But I bet it was true. I bet they did live slovenly, the poor one, you know, the average one, and maybe even some of the Polish elites and landowners maybe did. And Bismarck, too, there was a commission for colonization that was established in the Bismarck era that could, in the course of two decades, bring no more than 11,957 families to the Eastern Territories. But Frederick the Great settled a total of 57,475, but somewhere he's known to have brought 300,000 Germans into Prussia, but that contradicts this other one. So I don't know if that's just a rumor, something that's said. It's an estimate of some kind, but these are the numbers that were given. Frederick increased the German character of the population in the monarchy's provinces to a very significant degree. This all started around 1807, where the Germans were able to continue to try to bring Germans into Prussia and make it more German. But the Poles were still the majority population and still the majority landowners by quite a bit. But when I was in my very short period of time in Poland, that I took the train from Dresden, and the train went through the southwestern area. And it got drearier and drearier, and I realized I was going through a kind of industrial area, but it went through the Katowice area and others along there. And my gosh, the train stopped at a lot of stations, and I was shocked at the way they looked. And this was in 2009 or 2008 maybe. No, 2009 for sure. And they were really poor. I mean, the platform, the train station platforms looked like they came from the Soviet era, and they hadn't been touched with a paintbrush or clean. They weren't dirty in the sense of trash around, but everything looked kind of dirty because it wasn't painted. It was just worn out, you know, and old, and the people walking around there, not a lot of people, but they looked, you know, just in not very, you know, nice, just poorly dressed, and, you know, they just looked dejected, kind of. And I tried looking down the streets, and it just looked like it was a train station area, but it looked like not a very exciting, not very spiffed up at all. And it went on like that until I got closer to Krakow, and then Krakow was much nicer. That's their big tourist city. But, I mean, really, they haven't been able to do anything. And it kind of shocked me because I didn't come across that anywhere else. And then in Krakow, that first night there was no decent restaurant right there in the tourist area after 9 or 10 p.m. It was a little bit late, true, but everything was closed, and or what was open wasn't what you'd want, you know, really liked. I was just very surprised at the welcome. And in this material I had written, I mean, I was reading that was from back in the 20s, let's see, the 20s and 30s. They talked, the persons talked about how unwelcoming, how bad that they treated tourists, and how unpleasant it could be there. And they just, if they're not really working hard and woken up about what to do, they don't do a very good job. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of wrapped up in themselves, poles, yeah. I think. I'm being mean, but anyway.
No, I think you're being quite honest.
Yeah.
I think
that's the end of that section, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, so we've got the next one coming up. I have a timeline, and it's back to General Stilwell on the 13th of May. He and his party crossed the Chindwin River, and now they're almost certainly safe from the Japanese, but still dependent on their own supplies in a very remote area and racing to beat the monsoon. That's all I've got for that day.
Okay. 13th of May, 1942, at dinner. Political instability of Vichy, France's alternatives, the inadequacy of Bétaigne, mistrust of Laval, dangers of a phantom government, what Germany will keep. The thing that strikes me above all in the present-day policy of the French is the fact that because they were anxious to sit on every chair at the same time, they have not succeeded in sitting firmly on any one of them. The explanation is that the soul of the country has been torn asunder. In the Vichy government alone, a whole heap of tendencies is apparent. Anti-Semitic nationalism, clerical pro-Semitism, royalism, the spirit of revolution, and so on. And as a final misery, if an energetic man make a mistake, there seems to be no provision in the political plan whereby a swift and clear-cut decision can be reached. There are nevertheless only two possible courses which the French policy can pursue, and France must choose one of the following. A. She must renounce her metropolitan territory, transfer her seat of government to North Africa, and continue the war against us with all the resources of her African colonial empire, or B, she must join the Axis powers and thus save the greater part of her territory. She must intervene in Central Africa and ensure for herself possessions there, which will compensate her for the loss of the territories which she will inevitably have to cede when the peace treaty is signed to Germany, Italy, and Spain. If she adopts the second alternative, France will not only have a chance of participating actively in the war against Britain and the United States, and thus of realizing her ambitions in Africa, but she will also win the goodwill of the Axis powers. If France makes this decision, our communications to North Africa will be child's play. Further, such a decision would accelerate the entry of Spain into the war, and the French fleet would immediately become an important factor in the current military operations. Her fortunes, then, would all be staked on one card. If she comes in with us, however, she must clearly understand that it is essential for us to retain the strategic positions which we at present occupy on the Channel coast. At the same time, she must resign herself to the idea of satisfying the territorial demands of Germany, Italy, and Spain, both in Europe and in Tunisia. She will be able to compensate herself by conquests in Central Africa. On the other hand, if she adopts the first solution, or if she persists in her present equivocal attitude, then she must expect to lose all along the line. Somehow or other, the Americans will get a grip on Martinique, while Britain will not only never dream of giving up Madagascar, but will also certainly do her best to recoup her far eastern losses by thrusting towards southern and western Africa with the object of founding new dominions there. Spain will not withdraw her demands, nor will Italy, And Japan certainly has no intention of restoring Indochina to France, where the latter now has nothing more than a caricature of a government. A country whose future depends on so tragic an alternative requires at its head a man capable of coldly facing the consequences of the situation. Marshal Pétain is not the man. It is true that he has extraordinary authority over the French, but he owes this primarily to the prestige conferred on him by his great age. When it is a question of taking decisions upon which everything, absolutely everything, depends for the future of his country, I think that the experience of a man of that age is of itself a handicap. For myself, I admit that I now think twice before giving a decision in a case where 10 years or so ago I should have jumped without hesitation. Such being the situation, I feel that any meeting with Marshal Pétain would be devoid of interest, in spite of the respect in which I hold this upright man, who, when he was in Spain, always maintained courteous relations with our ambassador, and who, moreover, has never ceased to advise his government to come to terms with Germany. To make a comparison, I would say it would be like giving the principal part in an opera to some famous old singer covered with glory, and then, when faced with a deplorable result, consoling oneself by saying that 20 or 30 years ago, anyway, he had a throat of gold. It is a great pity that among Pétain's colleagues there is not one capable of taking the decisive action required. Laval, for example, is nothing but a parliamentary hack. The net result is that the Vichy government has no real power. A phantom government is always a source of danger. If France is at the moment safe from disintegration, protected against the threat of a coup de main or a civil war, she owes it all to the presence of our occupation troops, who constitute the only real power in the country. During an inspection I was making of the Atlantic Wall constructions, I was accosted by one of the workmen. "Mein Führer," he said, "I hope we're never going away from here. After all this tremendous work, that would be a pity." There is a wealth of wisdom in the man's remark, for it shows that a man hates to abandon a place on which he has worked so hard. I need scarcely say that nothing on earth would persuade us to abandon such safe positions as those on the Channel coast, captured during the campaign in France and consolidated by the organization Tote, and retire into the narrow confines of the North Sea. In the same way, we must organize the Crimea in such a manner that even in the dim future we should never be constrained to leave to others the benefits of the work we have done there. We shall have to modernize the ports of the Crimea and establish strong fortifications on the narrows which command the approaches to the peninsula. These fortifications will have to be so strong that the workmen who constructed them will themselves be convinced that here we have an impregnable position. It will be sufficient to have just one such base in the Crimea, for the Black Sea has for us an interest that is purely economic, and as we have no interest in the Mediterranean, this should give us, after the war, a chance of establishing really amicable relations with Turkey. I like that section right there because of his, particularly the analyzation of France and what France is going to have to decide, mm-hmm. and his analytical mind on that. If France had had a leader that would have been able to think like Hitler, and says, okay, you know, we're either going to have to join Germany in this fight, or we're going to lose everything we got. And to think that way. And he just said, unfortunately, Pétain was not that man, and his colleagues were even further away from being that man. But, yeah. And I think he hit the nose on the problem right on the nose by saying, here's France's options, and they can select which way they're going to go. But if they go this way, this is going to happen. If they go this way, this is going to happen.
He was strategizing, and he was right from his perspective then, but his perspective was that Germany was going to stay strong And, you know, that it didn't turn out that way. So in the, in the end, the French would say, well, we're glad we did what we did and we held off because, you know, then we would have been, we would have helped Germany or something. Of course, that could have changed things, too. It would have been so helpful. You know, then I think it's very interesting that that he had said, I admit that I think twice before making a decision now that 10 years ago I wouldn't have to think twice about it.
Yeah.
And didn't, you know, and saying when the older you get, the more careful and you are and the more cautious and too much so, you know. So that was a nice admission that he made there.
Sure.
He said, I don't mind admitting it. And that Atlantic Wall, wow, what a thing that was. They had that all the way down the coast of Norway and back up again the coast of Norway to where Sweden was and then all the way down the northern part and along France until you got below England. That was really something, and they had the most amazing fortifications there.
That's right.
So I can understand that man saying, boy, I hope we don't have to give this up. He had been working on it. The Germans built such wonderful things, and so much of it's just been, well, some of it's there, you know, just to look at. They were really protecting Europe from England and from America with that long stretch. Go ahead.
That's true, and what a lot of people maybe never thought of was that there was some very real concern by the planners of the D-Day invasion that the Allies could well have been thrown back. There was a chance that they were not going to be able to land all those forces, and it was because of all those fortifications, and they knew that they were likely to come under such a hammering that, you know, they had to face the possibility that they would get thrown back and have to go back to England. And so, you know, that in itself...
I think it was treason, Ray. I think it was treason on the German side that caused that to be successful. It shouldn't have been successful.
I think you're exactly right. So
I'd like to study up on that some more, but I have read quite a bit about it. It's hard to, you know, you can't say for sure... But it sure looks like it. Everything was all confused. And they try to blame it on Hitler. He wasn't paying attention. He couldn't make up his mind. And he was using proper caution because the idea was they would act like they were going to land here and they were really going to have their real landing there. And so they were expecting something like that. And when they get first reports, you know, you can't just throw all your firepower and so on and your troops there, and then they're going to come and really do the real thing further down. So you have to wait and watch, and there was all these conflicting reports and so on, and a lot of that was by Germans who were absolutely rotten rats. It's just disgusting what happened. It was bad enough on the Eastern Front. Then what happened on the Western Front with that from then on was really awful. Well, if you don't want to say more about that, I will say that I wanted to bring up this thing about people will say, you know, we're talking about the Germans asserting their authority in the areas where they were occupying and wanting to Germanize them and weaken their people who were living there so they couldn't stand up against them. And all these pro-Europeans now and white nationalists and so will say, well, see, he was seeing other white people as his enemies, you know, instead of friends and trying to work with them and help them and so on. Well, you know, at that time, Europeans were competing with one another and they were trying to be friends. And if you didn't win, you were going to lose, you know. I mean, it's not just that war, but in everything, you know, they're cutting each other's throats in order to get the advantage. And you just didn't work, and I don't think it would actually even work today. People want to think it would work. It's a nice ideal and a goal to have, but it's that sense of I want to own my area and I want to get as much of yours as I can, you know, still exists. So.
Oh yeah, it was a very selfish, nationalistic type thing there, and what Hitler had hoped to do, of course, was to unite Europe, but you know, Germany would have to be the bell cow, so to speak. You know, he made his plans known years and years in advance that let's protect Europe and the United States from the communist Soviet Union. And if, you know, England had the strongest navy in the world, Germany had the strongest land forces, and he felt like together that they could ensure a European future for Europe. I think that was his goal was, and unfortunately when the Americans and the British forced him to fight and conquer territory, I think that his goal was maybe even to introduce not so much National Socialism, because he said, you know, National Socialism is not for everybody or whatever, but I think the main thing that he could have introduced to conquered countries was the German money program and taking control of its own money supply and showing them what could be done when you don't belong to the international debt monster, when you control your own money and what you can do with it. And had he been able, had the time to instill some of that in some of the European countries, I kind of think that would have been a huge step in people opening people's eyes instead of thinking in terms of a Yugoslavian, let's say, or a Belgian, or even a Frenchman, that let's think in terms here of a community of Europeans. So,
well, he wanted to protect Europe,
yes.
And you know, because in that way he protected Germany, you know, and so he thought the Germans. He knew that his Germans were the strongest, most disciplined, most organized,
right.
And he thought the English were also very good at all of that. So he had the right idea, and it wouldn't have been painful to anybody else particularly so much. But you know, today they give a different story about the whole thing,
right?
Trying to make him look as bad as possible. Well. We've got, we're going to have to close now, of course, so we're running out of here probably.
Yeah. And I was going to say this next section is too long to tackle, but, you know.
And it goes back into domestic areas.
Yes.
And I think we did today was kind of all goes together real nicely.
I do, too. And one thing I wanted to stress for our listeners here, you know, when you called me about this project and we talked a little bit about it, you know, you talked about the skepticism of people that criticized the heck out of analyzing Hitler's table talk, that it was a false book. It was written by Martin Bormann, things like this. And you know, both of us went into it open-minded and says, okay, the only way we'll come to an opinion is to analyze it in the way it should be analyzed. I think tonight's program, with those remarks, those side notes about Bormann, and you hit the nail on the head when you said that he allowed this discussion to go on. He didn't change the words himself. He didn't impose himself on what was being said. He let it be said, and then he came in and says, well, that may be Gauleiter Forster's idea, but it's not right. But he didn't erase it. He didn't change it.
No.
And so, to me, tonight's lesson is kind of stacked up on our side that for those of us that think this was legitimate talks by the Fuhrer.
Well, right. I'm convinced it's totally legitimate, and I'm learning so much about Hitler and the National Socialist regime, the Third Reich, by reading it. I think it's just great. So I know a lot of people also think that. And maybe some of these people who are criticizing so much, I don't hear them anymore. At least they don't come to my website and write comments about it and criticizing it. They don't say a word. And I would post them, some of them anyway, if they did. Well, okay, Ray, we're going to take our Thanksgiving break for the next week, and wishing you and wishing everybody a great Thanksgiving. What do you want to say before we sign out here?
The same thing. I want to wish to all of our listeners and to you a very nice Thanksgiving holiday and look forward to getting back the week after Thanksgiving.
Okay, so we'll see you then 2 weeks from tonight. Thanks for listening.
Thank you and good evening.